Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
All right, season one, episode two of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Redcon One, Old School Labs, Six Pack Bags, and Florida Alternative Medicine. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to episode two of season one of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Glad to have you guys back. Hope you enjoyed our interview last week with Randy Roach on episode number one. And we are continuing our discussion about the movie Pumping Iron, since this is the 40th anniversary of that movie. And today's guest is one of the guys who was out at Gold's Gym. He's one of the original crew of the original Gold's Gym out in Venice, California. His name is Roger Callard, and Roger was one of the top bodybuilders during the 1970s. He was featured very extensively in Joe Weider's Muscle Builder magazine. And he's also a training partner and a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ken Waller and a lot of those guys. We had a great discussion with Roger. Roger is also a great athlete. He went to Michigan State University, and he played football and wrestling and boxing and track and field, and he was a really great athlete. And then he moved to California in the early 1970s, around 1972, started training with Arnold and started competing in bodybuilding and won the Mr. International contest in 1978. He competed against Mike Mensur and Robbie Robinson and Danny Padilla and Pete Kromkowski and a lot of the greats. He's got a great personality, and it was great hearing from Roger about some of the old stories of bodybuilding and training with Arnold, making the movie Stay Hungry, and he even talks about stealing Mike Katz's t-shirt. So we got a great, great interview coming up with Roger Callard in a minute. Before we go to that, though, I want to thank our sponsors for sponsoring, again, the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, episode number two. First of all, I want to thank our sponsor, Redcon One. Everybody wants to be a champion, and everybody wants to be the best. And at Redcon One, they believe in working hard at achieving your goals. Whether it's to kill it in the gym or run a six-minute mile, Redcon One has something for those willing to put in the work. Their premier clinically dosed pre-workout, Total War, is the perfect companion to your workout to give you the extra push to break through your mental and physical barriers. And then you can fuel your body after those workouts with the revolutionary MRE. It's the only whole food complete meal replacement with protein from salmon, chicken, beef, and eggs. And the carbs come from sweet potatoes and oats, and it also includes 10 grams of fat from MCT oil. This is the best tasting complete meal you will ever have. So go to redcon1.com and try the very best sports nutrition has to offer. Redcon One, the highest state of readiness. And as a sponsor to the show, Redcon One is offering a discount code LEGENDS to get 15% discount off your order. Again, that's redcon1.com and use the discount code LEGENDS and get 15% discount off your order. We're also brought to you by Old School Labs, and Old School Labs makes uncompromisingly premium supplements. They draw on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements to the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with, and it's the brand that I personally use to compete and win the Natural Mr. Universe in the Masters division in 2012. I personally use the Vintage Blast and the Vintage Build in my workouts. I take that as my pre-workout drink, and they've also got a great supplement called Vintage Burn, which is a great fat burner. Go to oldschoollabs.com and use the discount code LEGEND12 and you'll get 12% off your order. You can also visit them at amazon.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. We're also brought to you by Six Pack Fitness. Six Pack Fitness creates premium iconic meal management bags, healthy competitor-friendly hot sauces and accessories geared toward everyone from the serious athlete, bodybuilder, CrossFit, or fitness enthusiast. They provide stylish and innovative solutions for those who live active, healthy lifestyles. Their products are designed to keep everyone organized and prepared so they can focus on their fitness goals, training hard, eating right, and staying healthy. Check them out at sixpackbags.com and use the promo code LEGENDS10 to receive 10% off your total purchase. These are awesome bags if you guys need to bring your meals with you, whether you're going out for the day to work, or you're going away for the weekend, or you're going on a trip. Go to sixpackbags.com and pick out the bag that works for you. You'll really, really love these bags. And finally, I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. Do you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential? Then come see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff who will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They also offer a wide range of services to ensure that you will not only look and feel amazing, but are comfortable knowing that they are there for you every step of the way. They have very competitive pricing along with quality products and services, and those are just a few additional reasons to give them a try. So give them a call for more information and experience firsthand what sets them apart from the rest. They look forward to hearing from you and working together with you on your specific goals. Visit them at opeshealth.org, that's opeshealth.org, or you can give them a call at their office at 813-906-6737. And you can also use a promotion code LEGEND for ordering from Florida Alternative Medicine. You'll get a free consultation and you'll get 20% off any package that you order. That's opeshealth.org, opeshealth.org. All right. Thank you very much for those sponsors for sponsoring us. We could not do it without you. And we appreciate you supporting this Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right. Last week was 4th of July. And I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but at Muscle Beach out in Venice, California, they always have a Hall of Fame on the three summer holidays, Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day. And this last week, on the 4th of July, they inducted Kent Keen into the Hall of Fame. And for those that know your history in bodybuilding, Kent Keen was a training partner of Arnold Schwarzenegger back in the 1970s. I think you can see his picture in the book Pumping Iron. I think he was also in the movie Pumping Iron. So Kent has been around for a very, very long time, so I was glad to see him be inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Muscle Beach Hall of Fame out in Venice Beach, California. I'm friends now with Phil Williams, the 1985 NPC Nationals winner. We did a great interview with Phil that is right now on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. We did a great interview about his career. So Phil is now living out in the Venice, California area. He was in California, but he relocated closer to Gold's Gym. He's doing personal training out there. So if you're in Venice, California, and you want to train with a real, real champion, contact Phil Williams out at Gold's Gym out there. He posted some pictures on Instagram, and he was hanging out with Manny Perry, who was one of the great bodybuilders in the late 70s. Manuel Perry was in the 1977 and 78 Mr. America, a great potential, big guy, wide shoulders. And then he went on to have a career as a stuntman in Hollywood. He was doubling for Lou Ferrigno for The Incredible Hulk and still doing that. He's had an incredible career in Hollywood being a stunt person. So it's good to see him in the pictures. He looked really in good health. Also, Bob Birdsong was in the pictures with Phil, and Bob looked really good. Bob's getting up there in age. I'm sure he's got to be in his mid to late 70s now, and he looked really good. He looked healthy and lean. And Tony Pearson was out there. We hope to get Tony on one of my interviews for the Bodybuilding Legends show pretty soon. Tony looks amazing. I think he's 60 years old this year. He still looks in incredible shape. He's training hard like he's still competing, you know, and he's ripped and always in great shape. And I think he guest posed at the Mr. Muscle Beach show they had out there that they do outside. And Bill Grant was also out there, and Bill's looking great. Bill, I think, just turned 70, and arms are still as good as ever. And we've got Bill on the show next week on the podcast. So we're going to be talking to Bill next week about his contribution to the movie Pumping Iron. He was also in the book. So it's good to see all those guys out there. I also just recently did an interview with Mike Christian. It was a two-part interview that's also on BodybuildingLegendsShow.com. So if you guys haven't checked that out, please go on and check that out under our video section. Mike gave a really, really good interview. We got some great contest clips from all the shows he did it when he competed in the Mr. Olympia from 1985 to 1990 and winning the Pro World in 1988. And when he competed against Rich Gaspari in the Pro World in 86. I've even got the clip from when him and Gaspari were on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and Arnold back in 1989, right before the very first Arnold Classic. So they're going to be presenting Mike Christian with Hall of Fame award at Muscle Beach on Labor Day. So that'll be in a couple of months. So congratulations to Mike on that. Very well deserved. Mike is back in the scene again, and he's living in Texas and training hard. He's doing some personal training, but he looks great too. He's gotten in really good shape. We had some bad news also on July 4th. Gene Mosé, who was one of the great writers in Joe Weider's magazines back in the 1970s, he used to work for Muscle Builder magazine, and he did a lot of articles and was a photographer. He was also a bodybuilder back in his day. Gene passed away, unfortunately. I'm not sure how old he was. He had to be probably in his 80s. I think he was living in a nursing home. I read that on John Balick's Facebook page. He said he visited him a couple of weeks ago. And Gene was also writing for John Balick's Iron Man magazine, I think around the same time I was, not too long ago, right before John sold the magazine. Gene had a lot of history in the sport, a lot of knowledge. He trained with Arnold many times, and he had some really great articles, not only in Muscle Builder, but also in Iron Man about Arnold's training programs and Sergio Oliva's training programs. And Gene was one of the old school bodybuilders that was still involved in the sport, still taking pictures probably all the way up until the last few years, worked for Ironman for many, many years. He's actually even in a scene in Pumping Iron. It wasn't in the original movie, but it was in the extra scenes that was in Raw Iron. And the part where Arnold is sitting in the office with Joe Weider and he's flexing his bicep, and the guy he's sitting next to, that's Gene Mosé, that he's flexing his bicep for, talking about his brachialis muscle and things like that. Rest in peace, Gene. He did some fantastic work in the bodybuilding world, and we really appreciate his contributions. Right now, I am working on an interview with Roy Callender for our Bodybuilding Legends series. So that should be coming out in the next couple of weeks in July. So Roy, of course, was one of the great bodybuilders in the 1960s and the 1970s. He really hit his peak in the 1970s. He was competing back in the late 60s with Arnold at the 1967 Mr. Universe in Napa in London. And then he was also in the 1968 IFBB Mr. Universe in Miami Beach, where Frank Zane famously beat Arnold Schwarzenegger. So he's got some great stories of Arnold and back in the old days. And then Roy took a hiatus. I think he took like 5 years off or 6 years off. And then he came back in 1977 and he won the Mr. Canada show and he just killed it. He was unbelievable. He was in incredible shape. Jimmy Caruso was training him out in Canada. And then he went on to win the Mr. Universe that year in the medium class in 1977 in Nimes, France. And after that, he had a great career as a professional bodybuilder, taking second to Robbie Robinson in his very first pro show, the 1978 Night of the Champions. And he did well in the Mr. Olympia in the late 70s. And then he was involved in the 1980 Mr. Olympia out in Sydney, Australia. And he looked fantastic there. And I think he hit his peak in 1981 when he competed against Franco and Tom Platz and Danny Padilla in the 1981 Mr. Olympia. So that was very controversial, Mr. Olympia. So we talked about all that stuff in our extensive interview. I think I talked to him for about an hour and a half. So it was really good to talk to Roy Callender. And like I said, that interview is going to be coming up in a couple more weeks. It'll be coming out this month in July. All right, we got some great response from our first show last week, our interview with Randy Roach. I actually got a couple emails from some people, so people are asking me questions. If anybody out there has any questions you want to ask me or about the interviews we do or about my personal experience or my history in the sport, send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com, and we will read your questions on the air. So I got a couple questions here from our show last week, so I appreciate you guys supporting the show and sending the questions out. This one is from Mike out in Madison, Wisconsin. He said, "Dear John, I loved your first show with Randy Roach. You always deliver quality. Thank you very much. And you know your stuff when it comes to bodybuilding history." He says, "You mentioned on the show that you were at the very controversial 1981 Mr. Olympia in Columbus, Ohio," which I just talked about with Roy Callender. And he says, "Where would you have placed the top six in that contest? Good luck with your podcast. Keep up the good work." Yeah, I wrote a big article about that. I think it was on RX Muscle a couple of years ago. And it was about the 1981 Mr. Olympia. And Randy Roach actually used portions of that article for his last book, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, which I think was Volume 3, Book 1, he called it. But I thought the top three in that contest, without a doubt, and I think most of the audience felt the same way, was Tom Platz, Roy Callender, and Danny Padilla. Those three guys hit their lifetime peak condition in that 1981 Mr. Olympia, and it was amazing to see three guys like that who were all kind of a surprise, because I know Tom was I guess you could consider him like the second tier of pro bodybuilding right before that contest. Because I think in 1980, I think Tom only took eighth or ninth place. And he was always known as the leg guy. But in that one year from 1980 to 1981, Tom did an incredible job of bringing up his upper body. His upper body looked amazing. And I know some people criticized him and said he shouldn't have won the Olympia that year because he was out of balance and his legs were way too big. His legs were bigger than his upper body, but he brought up his upper body so much, he must have put on at least 15 or 20 pounds of muscle. And I think most of it was on his upper body. So Tom was at his best. Roy Callender, as I mentioned, was at his best. Roy was always a big, thick guy. But in that contest, he was ripped along with his thickness. And he had an incredible amount of aggressiveness on stage, which I seen him compete in 77 when he was in the Mr. International in Columbus. And he lost to McAway. And I also saw him compete in 78 and 79 at the Mr. Olympia. And no matter what kind of condition he was always kind of laid back. He wasn't very, very aggressive. But in 81, it was like he knew he could win it. And he really developed, he really had his confidence. And he looked amazing. He was at his lifetime best. And of course, Danny Padilla, who had one of the most genetically gifted structures and one of the most perfect physiques in the bodybuilding world, but he was only 5'2". Danny always came into the shows just a little bit off, even despite his great genetics and his great proportions and his great symmetry. Everybody was always telling him ever since like 1976, 77, Danny, just come in ripped and you'll beat everybody, even if you are 5'2". So Danny finally came in super, super ripped in that 1981 Mr. Olympia, and he looked just phenomenal. If you look at pictures of him from that show, he just looks like physique perfection. So where would I place it? Like I said, I think those three were definitely the top three. Chris Dickerson was in it. Chris looked amazing the year before, 1980. His physical peak, I think, was in 1980 at the Olympia. In 81, he was good, still had great symmetry, great physique, really, really ripped, really in great condition, had those great legs. But he didn't look as big. He looked like he didn't train as hard in 81 as he did in 1980. Maybe he wasn't really planning to do the show. I don't know. But I know in 1980 he was training with Bill Pearl, who was his coach. So although he looked great, I thought those other three guys, Platts, Callender, and Padilla, had Dickerson beat. And Franco, now I didn't see Franco win it in 1976. I didn't go to that show. But I thought Franco looked really, really good. I mean, he's been really criticized for his win at that show. But I thought he really had a great physique. He was really ripped. He was very, very thick. His upper body was incredible. His abs were amazing. I thought even his arms, which were one of his weak points, were really much, much stronger. His back, of course, was great. But his chest, his delts, all those front shots, all those crunching shots looked just incredible. But he had no legs. And when I say he had no legs, I mean, he had some thickness in his thighs. It's not like they were real skinny. And he had good developed calves. You know, Franco always had those bow legs, so he didn't have the greatest genetics or structure for bodybuilding, but his thighs just had no separation. I was sitting, I think, in the third or fourth row for both the pre-judging and the night show, so I had great seats, and I watched every part of that contest, and Franco just had no separation in his quads whatsoever. And you're going up against Chris Dickerson, who has fantastic legs, Padilla, Callender, and of course Platts all had outstanding legs. So you got to figure by the 1980s, by the early 1980s, bodybuilders were really, really developing their legs. Where in the 1970s, you know, if you look at Arnold and Serge Nubre and Ferrigno, all those guys, they always had better upper bodies than their legs. But by the 1980s, the leg development was totally turning and everybody had outstanding legs. So yeah, Franco was no better than fifth just because of his legs. I would have had Dickerson in fourth. And then the top three, believe it or not, I would have had Padilla in third. And I know the Danny Padilla lovers out there hate me for saying that. But I just thought when you look at pictures of Danny, he looks perfect. And he looks like he could have easily have won. But when he was standing next to the calendar and he was standing next to Platts, he was so ripped, he almost looked a little small. And he didn't quite have the aggressiveness that those other two guys had. So he just didn't come off as the winner, and I would have had him in third place, but I easily could have saw him winning it too. I would have had Callender in second because, like I said, he was at his lifetime best. He had the confidence. He had a great posing routine. So I would have had him in second, and I would have had Platts in first. I thought Platts it was just his night. You know, he deserved to be Mr. Olympia that night. He had it all together. You could tell this guy worked so, so hard for a whole year. For 12 months, he just killed himself in the gym. And I think that's why he was the people's champion, because people could see that Tom Platz in 1981 just killed himself to win that contest. And when he got on stage, it just all came together. He had it all. He had the muscle mass. He had the quality. He had the charisma. It was just his night, and he really got robbed by not winning that contest. But he became so, so popular after that contest because of the physique that he presented on stage. But that was really his night. I thought he deserved to win. And, you know, we take for granted now, and these guys today, these bodybuilders today, they're putting on 20, 30 pounds in a year, and it's no big deal. But back then, the drug usage wasn't the same. I don't think GH was really around. Guys weren't taking insulin. They were taking steroids, but they weren't taking the same amount and the same stuff they're taking now. So if a guy puts on 20, 30 pounds in 6 months now, it's not really a big deal. But back then, to put on, I remember Frank Zane, when he was winning the Mr. Olympia, he would only gain like 3 pounds a year, but it was in the right places. And you could tell the difference, and it made a big difference for him. But with Platz gaining, like, I don't know how much weight he actually put on. It looked like he put on 15 pounds of muscle. And to do that, you know, he killed himself in the gym. You know, he ate a lot of calories. You know, I mean, his squatting, his leg training workouts are legendary even today. So, you know, he really, really put the work in. And I think that's why people responded so positively to him. And he was just the crowd favorite from the prejudging and the night show. So that's why it was such a controversial show, because Franco did win. And of course, he didn't have those legs. So we're probably going to do a series of interviews about the 81 Olympia after we get done with this season one, where we're talking about pumping iron, because I think that would be a great topic to talk about, the 1981 Olympia, probably the most controversial. Everybody says the 1980 is, but I think the 81 Olympia was actually even more controversial than 1980. All right, I got another question here. This is from Australia, Joseph from Australia. He says, "Hey, John, I'm glad you have your own show. I used to love your Natural Bodybuilding radio show a few years ago." All right, thank you. And he goes, "I have a question for you." He goes, "What are some of the memories you have from when you attended the Mr. Olympia contest from 1977 to 1979? It must have been great to see those shows as a teenager." Yeah, it was great to see those shows. Wow, so many great memories. I mean, probably the first one I went to in 1977, I was only 14. So to see those quality bodybuilders and so many iconic figures that you only read about in magazines was really amazing for me. The one guy I really remember, and the one great memory I have, is from 1978, because Cal Skalak was one of my idols. Of course, Arnold was my idol, but Cal Skalak won the Mr. Universe that year. I'm sorry, he won it in 1977, and that was the year I started bodybuilding. So when I saw Cal win the Universe, when I saw him win that in the magazines, that was really inspirational to me, and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to go into bodybuilding, win Mr. Universe, stand on that platform and get the trophy and all that. So that was really the image that inspired me. So when I got to see him compete in the Mr. Olympia in 1978, which was his only Mr. Olympia, so I was very, very fortunate to be able to see that. That was really an amazing experience. Cal was just a real confident guy. At that time, he was actually undefeated in competition. He had gone in 5 contests and he won them all. He won Mr. Delaware when he was living in Delaware. Then he moved to California and he won Mr. California. Then he won the Mr. America, the AAU Mr. America in 1976. Then he won the Mr. USA, which he had to do, I think it was called the AFAB. It was associated with the IFBB. He had to go on that show in order to be on the team to go to the Mr. Universe. And then he won the Mr. Universe. And he beat Mike Mentzer, who was favored to win the Mr. Universe that year. And it was really, really a close show. So to me, this guy was just, he was the ultimate bodybuilder to me. He was a big dude. He had the Arnold kind of physique. He was very confident. He didn't take any shit from anybody. And I think the fans really loved him. And when he came out, and he only got 5th place in that contest because his legs were a little behind his upper body, especially his calves. But his upper body was just amazing, incredible. I mean, his arms, his chest, he had some of those most muscular poses. Just his whole upper body was just incredible. And he brought the house down for those that don't know it. I mean, back then they used to do their posing routine at the prejudging, and then they would do their same posing routine at night. I'm not really sure. I don't think they even used the music back then for their posing routines. I think they were just posing to the audience. But he just brought the house down. Like, people were actually standing up applauding when he got done. He was like the new Arnold. So it was just amazing to see him. That was definitely one of my greatest memories, was seeing Cal. And then, of course, he did this controversial crucifix pose when he only got fifth place. I don't think he should have won it that year, but it was just an incredible experience to see him. I never got to see Arnold in person at any of his contests because I was too young, but at least I got to see Cal, who was my other idol. Some of my other memories, I mean, the great pose down between Zane and Mensur in 1979, that was awesome. Zane, I think, was at his absolute peak in 1979, so I got to see that. I saw McAway win the 1977 Mr. International, which was held with the Mr. Olympia, and that was incredible to see. He was really an amazing bodybuilder. Then we also talked about 81, Tom Platz. So, yeah, I got to see some really, really amazing physiques during those 3 years. And then in 1979, they had the Mr. Universe with the Mr. Olympia. So I remember on Saturday, they had the Mr. Universe contest, which was super long. They only had four classes back then. They had the lightweight, middleweight, light heavyweight, and heavyweight. But we went to the prejudging, of course, and we sat through the whole thing. And then we went to the night show and watched that. And then the next night, on Sunday night, they had the Mr. Olympia. Back then, there was no women's bodybuilding. Back then, it was only the men. And they also had the Mr. International with the Mr. Olympia on Sunday. So there was a lot of bodybuilders. I remember when we left, me and my brother Don went with me, and he said, I don't ever want to see a bodybuilding show again for another year. We've seen so many bodybuilders in about 2 days. And I also got to see a great pose down with Samir Banoot and Ron Tufel in the light heavyweight class at Mr. Universe that year. And Samir just had an incredibly beautiful physique, great symmetry, small waist, and I always knew that guy was going to go far as long as he could come in ripped. And he was a little bit off that year, and Tufel was really, really ripped, but they made the right move, and they made the right decision to have Samir win the show because he definitely had a better physique. So anyways, those are some of my memories. Thanks, guys, for sending me those questions. I appreciate that. Keep the questions coming. I'll read them on the air, and I'll read your name. And thanks for supporting the show. Thanks for supporting the podcast. Please spread the word and subscribe to it on iTunes and leave some comments and rate it if you could. And we appreciate your support. All right. Well, let's get to our interview with Roger Callard, one of the top bodybuilders from the 1970s. And Roger's going to talk about his role in the movie Pumping Iron and his memories from those great golden era of bodybuilding. Here's Roger Callard. All right, we're back with our guest, Roger Callard, and Roger was one of the mainstays in the golden age of bodybuilding in the 1970s. He was a training partner and good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger back in the golden era, and he competed in the IFBB Mr. America and Mr. International, and he won the Mr. International in 1978. So we are here to talk about the movie Pumping Iron. Roger, welcome.
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm good. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Good to be on.
Well, Roger, let's talk about those days. We talked on the phone a little bit last week. You said that those were some amazing times back in the 1970s. Now, you're originally from Michigan, and I remember when Arnold wrote several things about you, and he always said you were a great athlete. So tell us a little bit about your athletic background.
I was an all-around athlete, actually. I played baseball with Steve Garvey at Michigan State. My coaches won 12 Super Bowls.
Wow.
Brad Van Pelt, Joe DeLaMalier, Bill Simpson, Rich Bonsall. We didn't have a great record, but we drafted about 11 guys. And we were a very physical team, and we were probably one of the forerunners of weight training in that era, because it's a funny story. George Perlis was our defensive back coach, and he came up to me, and he goes, Callard, come over here. And I walked over, and he goes, you're getting too big. And I said, well, I have the highest vertical leap on the team, right? He goes, yeah. I said, well, I have the fastest 40 on the team too, right? He goes, yep. I said, well, I don't think I'm getting muscle bound. And he kind of walked away and scratched his head. And a year or so later, he went to the Pittsburgh Steelers with Chuck Knoll and really made a 180 as far as his ideology as to training. And I don't know if you remember, but Mike Webster was on that team. And the offensive line, you had to bench 500 to be on the line. So we were right at the cusp of when people thought that there was just such a thing as muscle bound. I mean,
yeah,
they wouldn't let Muhammad Ali work out with weights. And Roberto Duran, who was a friend of mine, used to work out with weights all the time. And Ali would do it, you know, when Angelo and all those guys didn't see him.
Mm-hmm.
So we were really at the cusp of when people thought that there was such a thing as muscle bound. There was a myth. And now all of a sudden, guys like Bobby Fischer, chess players were working out.
Right.
Basketball players, finesse guy. But they told Steve Garvey he was too big when he went to the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted him to lose weight. Well, you know, look at the guys now. I mean, they're basically bodybuilders swinging some lumber, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So what sports were you in, Roger? You were in baseball, football?
I played everything. I played football, basketball, baseball, track.
Wow.
You know, your good athletes in that era played everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I could throw 100 miles an hour. I could vertical leap all over 4 feet. I mean, I could just bruise my elbow on the rim. I mean, I'm 5'10". We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But that was my main impetus, is that I wanted to be a better athlete. And what's funny is Kent Keene was about 27. Maybe he was even older than that. And he was at Michigan State, and I met him, and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm playing football. He goes, man, he says, you should be a bodybuilder. You've got great shoulders, great legs, you know, things that guys would kill to have.
That's
what Joe Reeder used to say to me, too. And so I ended up entering Mr. Michigan, and I think I came in second or third place, and then the next year I won it. But But my main thing, you know, was to run faster, jump higher, punch harder, hit the ball further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all about athletics. Because as I mentioned before, we don't run faster, we run longer. We take longer strides.
Yeah.
Because our knee speed is pretty much set. So sprinting and basically all of the sports, power is technique and power.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my main focus, was to become a better athlete.
So what got you into competing in bodybuilding in the early 70s? Because bodybuilding was kind of a cult thing right back then, right, in the 70s?
Well, no, there were guys like Sergio Oliva was from Chicago. He used to come around.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Freddie Lowe was an Olympic lifter from Michigan State.
Uh-huh.
So we were kind of a hotbed of Larry Pacifico was a power lifter.
Yeah, I know Larry. Yeah.
Norbert Szymanski had won the Olympics, you know, I think at 42. He was the oldest guy to ever win a gold medal.
Uh-huh.
So Michigan was kind of a bed of weight training, you know, the whole Midwest, really.
Yeah.
From New York all the way to Ohio or Pennsylvania, Michigan. You know, we had guys like Vic Seipke, Ron Thompson, Ron
mm-hmm.
Gibson was from there, Don Ross.
Yeah, Don Russell from Michigan, yeah.
And then later, you know, Samir and Tom Platz went to Michigan State, too. So
yeah.
Michigan really put out some very quality bodybuilders. If you look back at it, we produced some great athletes and some great bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we didn't just make cars and grow cherries.
So when did you come out to California, Roger?
I came out June 22nd, 1972, right after I got out of college. I had a tryout with the Chargers.
Okay.
And Don Coryell was the coach. And I saw a guy get hurt, and I saw the coach step over the guy, call another guy's number, and I said, you know what? I'm going to Santa Monica. I'm going to be in the movies, and I'm going to work out. I'd already talked to Dave Draper on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a party one night, and I snuck into a room, and I used somebody's phone, and I called his. He was listed, so I called him. And
oh, really?
Dave was very nice, and Dave and I became really good. We actually, you know, did a lot of woodworking together, and Dave was really the guy who started instinctive training. I mean, Weider coined all those terms.
Uh-huh.
What those were our workouts. That they weren't his ideas; they were our ideas.
Right.
And Dave was really a forerunner in instinctive training. In other words, he'd go in there and he'd go, okay, I did arms yesterday. I feel like I want to do a little more. Sergio would do that too. And you just kind of got in tune with your body and trained what you felt you needed, and you stopped when you felt you needed to.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like a stiff regimen, and I think that's how a lot of people end up getting hurt.
Yeah,
they
right.
go into the gym thinking, well, I gotta outdo my PR, and your body's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work like that. You know, it's like a car.
Yeah.
Cold mornings, it takes longer to warm up.
Right, right.
So
when you moved to, when you went to Santa Monica and started training out there, what gyms did you go to? Was it Gold's Gym?
Yeah. That was just a little, on 1010 Pacific,
little
hole in the wall, but it was beautiful. I mean, the skylights, and there was no girls allowed, but there were a couple of girls that came in there, and that was it.
Uh-huh.
There was a little upstairs mezzanine where they had showers and a bathroom, and then there was like a trap door where you could go up on the roof and you could sunbathe up there.
Uh-huh.
But the gym had a lot of skylights and louvered windows, and
yeah.
breeze would come in off the beach. It was great. And we'd open the back door and the front door, and it was a small, eclectic group of guys from all over the world. And, you know, we ate together, we trained together, we went to parties together, we competed against each other. I don't think that'll ever be duplicated again.
Yeah, I was.
And we fed off each other, John. You know, like if one guy needed calves, he'd train with this guy. If another guy needed arms, he'd train with that guy.
Yeah.
The guy needed muscularity, he'd talk to Zabo. Or if he needed, you know, advice on technique, he'd talk to Frank Zane. Or and then Arnold, you know, wanted calves and shoulders, so he trained with me and legs. And I wanted the arms and back. And so it was a symbiotic exchange, really.
Yeah.
What's going on and throughout the whole gym.
When did you first meet Arnold? What year was that, Roger?
As soon as I got there. I had already had an article in the Muscle Builder or whatever it was. The old magazine. It wasn't the Hoffman magazine, but I can't remember what it was. Anyway, Strength and Health or something. And they go, oh, you're the guy with the shoulders. I was wearing a plaid shirt. They go, oh, you're the guy with the shoulders. And, you know, Waller and I were football players, so we hit it off. And Arnold was very friendly. And Arnold had hurt his knee in Hungary.
Right, 72.
And I had hurt my back. And he goes, Roger, why don't we train together? So we did legs together. And it's kind of funny because we squatted on a Smith machine so that we did, you know, we couldn't rock forward because he had a bad knees and I had bad, my back was hurting.
Uh-huh.
And we would hide the plates that we were putting on from Waller, because Waller was the manager, because he said we were bending the machine. So we'd see if Waller was looking, and we'd slide the 25 off and put a 25 in behind it. So it looked like it was 225, and it was a 275. And he'd come out there, and the madder he got, the higher his voice would get. I told you guys. We go, oh, come on, Ken, relax. He goes, you're going to bend the goddamn machine. And we did bend it a little bit because we had our feet out in front of us.
Right.
So we would look and see if you, because he had that little office. And he, you know, he didn't have a straight-on view, so when he wasn't looking, we'd slide that 25 on and put the 45 over it real quick. So it looked like it was just 225.
Right.
But we had a great time, I mean, in those days. I mean, we used to, Arnold and I used to play so many games of him.
Mm-hmm.
We would, we'd go, he lived on California around 20th. So we'd drive both our cars down to the beach. I would grab my pickup, take him back to his place, and then we would run down to the beach and drive back in his car. So we'd do it at night so people didn't know we were running. Because we'd come into the gym the next day and we'd be all veins popping out. And they go, what the hell are you guys doing? Oh, nothing, you know, just laying on the beach. So we were really the first guys to do a lot of aerobics, running, actual running.
Yeah.
And the other thing we would do is we would go to a party right before the show. Guys have been dieting for like 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we would make a point of eating cake right in front of them. And then we would sneak outside and throw it up and then come back in and eat some more. And the look on these guys' faces, John, because, I mean, they were like, what are you doing? It mentally broke guys down.
Wow.
Because they couldn't understand how we were eating cake.
Right.
And because they've been dieting for 12, you know, 3 months.
Yeah,
They haven't even come close to a freaking cake, let alone seeing some guy, you know, that's in shape eating one. But that's the kind of shit we did. I mean, we had fun. We laughed. You know,
it seemed like you and Arnold really got along personality-wise, you know? It seemed like you guys were pretty good friends for a while.
Yeah. Well, I think I was the all-American kind of guy that mm-hmm. he never could be. And I kind of taught him the lingo and the phraseologies. And he, you know, I'd say something like, it's a whole new ball game. And the next thing, you know, I'd hear the next week, it's a whole new ball game. You know, he would be, you know, reiterating it. And
right.
Although he could never say my name.
Oh,
Collard. Collard, California. I mean, he couldn't, like Arnold. Weeder was the same way. Roger Collard. You know, Joe, it's Callard. What the hell? The Wacker?
Right.
I mean, sometimes I think he'd mispronounce your name on purpose, you know, just so people wouldn't know. He was funny. He was weird. But
How was your training back then, Roger? I mean, did you guys, you obviously were training for contests, but like in the off season, how would you train and what was your lifestyle like?
Well, we did two-a-days the last 12 weeks.
Okay.
The last six weeks we would do, you know, 9 workouts a week. So one day we'd come in the morning and do maybe chest and back and then come in at night and do legs, whatever. We were doing 9 workouts a week for
mm-hmm.
like maybe 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
But during the off season, we would come in, you know, train for an hour, hour and a half, you know, at the most. And we'd go to the beach, you know, we'd go eat. But we'd do a little running, but not much. We didn't
mm-hmm.
try. What Arnold and I figured out, and Zane, is that we didn't cut down for a contest. We actually got bigger. We got
right.
in shape 3 months before the show and put on muscle up. So you come in full.
Mm-hmm.
The mistake that guys make today and still is that they want to cut. Well, when you cut muscle.
Yeah.
Because your body can't do two things at once. You can't lose fat and water and not lose muscle.
Right.
That's a mistake a lot of people make in conditioning. They think, well, I'll work out and I'll lose weight. You'll gain freaking weight. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, the larger muscles will need fuel. You're hungry. You're better off going out and running for an hour and losing the fat and then going to the gym and trying to put muscle on. Because your body can't do two things at once. And what we would do is we would get in shape 3 months before the show.
Yeah.
And now we would gain muscle for the show. We would come in full. Well, and that's why we were able to outpose guys. You know, if you're dieting for 6-8 weeks and you go to a show, you cramp up. You're so sore the next day you can hardly walk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the mistake that almost every bodybuilder makes, is they try to cut down for the show.
Yeah.
And it's a lazy man's way of doing it. And you know, when we started training for a show, the day after it was over.
Really?
Yeah. Casey was the same way. We started training for that show the day that the show was over. That whole year we were training for that show.
So were you guys bulking up then at all in the off season or no? Not really.
No. Why would you, if you have a stone, why would you put sand over the stone and then take the sand off?
Right.
What's the point?
Yeah.
Bulk up. You know what bulk is? Fat and water.
Right.
It doesn't mean you're big. That's why guys wouldn't run. They were afraid their arms would get small. Well, guess what? Their arms were small. You know,
mm-hmm.
it has nothing to do with it. Once you get the fat off, then you find out what's underneath. And, you know, it's like
Geronda.
Anybody could be a cut-up supermarket chicken, you know, like he was. But it takes, you know, a bodybuilder to have big full muscles.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can be ripped and look like, you know,
right.
him or the guy Bass or whatever. I mean, big deal. You got ripped, but you weigh 130, 40, 50 pounds. You know?
Yeah, right.
So what? You're Bruce Lee. Okay, great.
Yeah, because Arnold was huge back then, right? 72, 73, 74, those were
probably... Well, when we were training, it was his biggest, I thought.
Yeah.
Actually, he wasn't as big as what people thought.
Oh,
he
really?
He would come into a show about 225.
Wow.
At
That's
the most.
Amazing. You look at pictures of him even now, and you can't even imagine he was only 225, especially at his height, you know, 6'1", 6'2".
Yeah. Well, he didn't have big legs.
Yeah.
His legs were not big. They were just, he had a good cut in them, but he didn't have great legs. He didn't have, and he didn't have wide shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
He had thick, you know, thick deltoids, but they weren't wide. And he
right.
had huge arms and huge back and huge chest.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you analyze his body, he didn't have great forearms. He didn't have great calves, I can tell you that.
He didn't have great calves?
No, no. He had them done in Mexico.
Really?
You know,
okay,
I
heard that rumor.
Really? Really?
Huh.
anyway, he had great arms, great chest, great back. It's like Franco. I mean,
yeah.
If Franco's not Arnold's best buddy, he never wins Mr. Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, that's not a good body. It's a, you know, his arms were not good. His
right.
back was great. His chest was great. But that's it.
Yeah.
The legs weren't good. The calves were not good. He was bow-legged. You know, he was a muscle-bound. He was a freak as far as strength. But as a
yeah.
Danny Padilla and Muhammad McAway had better bodies as a short guy.
Yeah.
You know, they were more complete. And Samir, if Samir doesn't bulk up and try to beat Lee Haney, he would have probably been the greatest Mr. Olympia of all time.
Yeah.
He made the mistake. He weighed 183 pounds, 187 pounds when he won Mr. Olympia.
Wow. That's amazing.
187.
Yeah.
And then he tried to go up to like 220. Well, what happened? He lost everything.
Right, right.
You don't get weighed on stage. Nobody goes up and measures you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody goes up and sees how strong, nobody arm wrestles you. Nobody has a tape measure. It's an
right.
optical illusion. And
so when you started competing in California, Roger, what was the goal? You know, because I know everybody today wants to turn pro and everything, but back then it was more about titles, right? You wanted to win maybe the Mr. America, Mr. Universe?
I just wanted to be the best in my weight class, and I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I think I was pretty underrated. I mean, I beat Mensah. I beat Samir, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Ravi and I beat everybody in the Olympia, and Ravi beat Frank Zane because we were judged on the same judging system, the 200-point system. It was the only time at the 76 Mr. International. And Ravi and I outscored everybody.
Hmm.
And I think Ravi beat... I don't remember who won that year. Was it Frank or Franco? I think it might have been Frank.
In 76?
I can't remember if it was 76. I think it was 76.
Yeah, Franco won the
year.
We
outscored everybody. I beat everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that was the last time they did it because it showed that the amateurs were as good as the professionals.
So what did they do? They were scoring it using a point system?
A 200-point system.
Okay.
Yeah. It was the first time they judged amateurs and pros using the same system, and they never did it again because Robbie and I beat everybody except... I remember Arnold, we came off the stage, and he goes, Roger, you guys got better applause than the guys in the Olympia. And I go, yeah, no, we did. And a lot of people think that's still one of the best contests. I know the guy, Frank Myers, the Pope, that's all he talks about is that contest.
Uh-huh. So that was
a great contest,
Olympia,
right? Arnold and Laura Moran in the early 70s.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that
I think they were some of the best, I mean, really.
Uh-huh.
Well, the sport was pure then, John. I mean, there was no, it wasn't about the money. It wasn't about, you know, drugs. It was about the love of the sport. The passion, you know, the love of doing what you're doing. And that era will never be duplicated. And I think that's, you know, why do you think the 70s are so popular? In every way, styles. Yeah. Because it was a time of where we questioned everything, and we were passionate about it. We protested. There, you know, there was violence in the streets, and but there was a purity going on because our country was finding out who we are. And I'll tell you, bodybuilding changed the frickin' world. It really did. It made armed forces. You know, U.S. Armed Forces seem like, can you imagine, you know, other countries looking at our athletes and I mean, that's really what the Olympics are about, and bodybuilding and sport and professional sports, is you're showing off your arsenal. You know, that this is something that, you know, we could turn John Cena and you know, Billy Graham and all these guys, you know, into warriors. I wanted to. I mean, that's what other countries see.
Yeah.
It changed the world in ways that I don't think historically we're able to grasp even yet. But I know that it did because I saw the change. You know, I was right there at the pulse of it.
Yeah, and people may not realize, those that weren't around back in the 70s, but not too many people even worked out back then. If you saw a guy walking down the street with a muscular build, that was very unusual.
And well, let's put it this way, John. It was weird to work out, and it was cool to smoke dope.
Now,
what is it now? It's cool to do both, I guess. I don't know. But we've gone so far, you know, the pendulum has swung so far.
Yeah.
That now, you know, everybody mentions it in their bio. What do you do? Oh, I work out. I lift weights. Nobody talked about lifting, working out, you know, in the early 60s. People don't realize it hasn't gone on that long, you know, and they don't know anything about it. I was the reason that there's four categories, because I was supposed to go to the Mr. Universe, and they ended up sending Mike Tapp. They ended up sending two heavyweights. And I told Tommy Minichione and Joe Weider, I said, well, no, they sent Cal Skulak and Mike Mentzer, and I said, Joe, why are you putting off the decision to who's the best in our country to an international body? You're not sending the best team. The best team is your best guy in each division.
Right.
If you can't make the decision in the United States, you can't send a guy because he's your head writer, and you don't want to, you know. And what happened? Cal beat Mike.
Right.
And then Danny Padilla didn't go because they sent Mike Katz and Ken Waller.
That was a big controversy. Yeah.
With Robbie.
Right.
So him and I both got screwed. And then the next year, of course, after my article, they cut out with four categories, which didn't help me any. But categories and stuff weren't like it. There were height categories. There wasn't even weight categories.
Right.
And I was a 195-pound middleweight, for Christ's sake. You know, I actually won the USA as a heavyweight because I was 200 pounds. But, you know, I was a 195-pound middleweight. So, you know, a lot has changed that people don't realize. We were the institutors of those changes. People just don't know history.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Any history. They know how to Google. That's about it.
Right. Hey, Rod, I got an argument with drugs. I know drugs are a problem in bodybuilding today. But back then, did you guys just use them for competitions? Or, you know, well, I know it's probably much, much less than what they're doing today.
The steroids?
Yeah.
No. The only time we were even using and they weren't illegal. They were legal. We only used them maybe 8 weeks before the show. But like I said, we were in shape 3 months before the show. So the steroids really didn't play a huge factor, like people think. You know, it was the training, the technique. And I still say that our training techniques that we did are the best. You know, you can dress a monkey up in a suit and say that this is a new thing. It's still a monkey in a suit, okay? There's nothing new about, you know, all these trainers, you know,
yeah,
weight loss and the Biggest Loser. These trainers are full of shit. They don't know their ass from a hole in the ground about working out.
Right.
You can make a guy lose weight. Doesn't mean you know how to train anybody or do, I mean, like throwing a bunch of tires or balancing on a ball. Are you kidding me? You know,
I know, it's ridiculous.
Because you invent something new doesn't mean it's good. You know,
right.
These ropes and all this bullshit that they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, kettleballs, you know, all that stuff that they're doing. It's just inertia stuff that's going to get you hurt.
Yeah.
They don't know anything about training. There's such a misconception about weight training. People think if they want to get faster at something, they have to do the weight training faster. The opposite is true. If you want to build speed, you slow it down and you pause.
Mm-hmm.
Look at a frog, how he jumps. He jumps with his ass against the back of his calves.
Mm-hmm.
If we were a frog, we could dunk the full length of the court. I mean, basketball players bend their knees about 3 or 4 inches when they jump. They don't go all the way down. You know, people have no idea how to train for power.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you really want to train for power, you pause, you stop. Look at the Olympic lifters. You know, if they can clean that weight, if they can wallow down and clean it, they can usually lift it.
Right, right.
You know?
That's a good point.
But most people couldn't squat with 225 and go all the way, sit down and stop.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be stuck. They can go down and stick their ass out and you know, go halfway down with 300 or 400. But if they go all the way down with 225, 240, they're stuck. Mousetrap.
Right.
You know.
So
in any movement, you know, all the way down.
Yeah.
See how heavy you go. And they go, well, I'll have to go lighter. You're not going lighter. You're just realizing that you're not that strong. I'll have to go lighter. No, you'll have to use a weight that you can actually freaking use, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you bench press for a competition, what do? You pause on the bottom. You got to stop. You don't go down and touch your chest and come back up.
Right.
Bounce it.
Right, right. So when you and Arnold were training, you guys did a lot of volume, but it really wasn't really heavy weight, right?
Oh, sure it was.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Sure it was. We do 15 reps of 315 on the bench.
Wow, okay.
I did 15 reps of 225 behind the neck.
Wow.
Bent over rowing with 275, 225.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were fucking strong.
And pretty high volume too, right, Ryan?
I did 50 reps of 300 pounds all the way down the squat.
Really? Wow.
Yes, it's still a record at Michigan State.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. To this day, right now, no one's broke that record.
Wow, that's crazy.
You know how I did it?
No.
I ran a mile in 4 minutes and 28 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
I averaged 64-67 second quarters. I would do that immediately after squatting. The record was 21. So I said, well, if I start running a mile as fast as I can and I just keep adding reps, I'll be able to do 50 reps. Well, first I did 25, and then I did 30, and then I did 40, and then I did 50. I could have done probably 60, 70.
Yeah.
But I was running a mile. I don't know if you know anything about track, but if you run a quarter in 70 seconds, you're hauling ass. If you run it in 60 seconds, you're probably, you know, 1% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Now you do four of those together, back to back, and that's a lot of high school records for 28 for the mile.
Right.
You know, it's a sprint. The mile is no longer a distance race. It's a sprint.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that guy from, where is he, Mogadishu, where his name, the guy who ran the 141 in the half mile.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2 50-second quarters.
Wow.
You know, Roger Bannister was the first guy to run a 4 minute mile, and he could only run a quarter, open quarter, in 53 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
But he could run four of them under 60 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think he ran his last quarter in like 54 seconds.
Right.
So it's a lot of strength training is about endurance, and that was my point.
Mm-hmm.
Is strength, power has nothing to do with strength and endurance. Most power lifters couldn't dunk a basketball or run around one lap of the track.
Right.
So really, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to do something, you know, respectable 50 times. You know, how many people can squat with 300 pounds all the way down? Not very many. And then now do 50 reps.
Unbelievable.
So do 50 reps, do 50 anything. Just do 50 full squats and wave your hand around 50 times.
Right.
You know, lift your ass up the bed 50 times, whatever it is.
Right.
It makes you think.
Hey, Roger, let's talk about 1975, the year they filmed Pumping Iron. But before they filmed Pumping Iron, they were filming Stay Hungry, and you were in that movie. So tell us a little bit about that experience, because they had a lot of bodybuilders from Gold's Gym go out there and
Stay Hungry was great, because now you got Sally Field, who's Gidget, who really hadn't done much other than, you know, playing Gidget. Jeff Bridges, you know, came from a pedigree family, really hadn't done that much. You got Richard Eglund, who, you know, Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
You got, what's his name, the guy from Magnum, Roger, the black guy, what was his name?
Oh, yeah,
Roger.
Yeah.
He was in it, the other guy. I mean, great actors after great actors. And really, it was a pivotal point in Sally Field's career. And she was actually dating Burt Reynolds at the time. Because Burt Reynolds had just done The End with Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
And Bob Rafelson hadn't done anything since Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider and Marvin's Garden. So it was really kind of a pivotal thing for Arnold, Sally Field, and Jeff Bridges and Bob Rafelson. I mean, everybody that was in that film. It was really a showcase for them.
Mm-hmm.
And George Butler and Charles Gaines were great. They were really nice guys.
Yeah.
You know? And it was really kind of Charles Gaines' story.
Yeah, it was his book, yeah.
Because his family was kind of well-to-do. And here he was involved with, you know, weight training and he had to buy a piece of real estate, and he ends up, you know, kind of being introduced to this world of bodybuilding. And
well, that was pretty much Charles'
story. Birmingham was a very interesting city. It was very interesting because, you know, we'd just undergone, you know, the racial tumult stuff.
Yeah.
The black people there were very friendly, in the southern hospitality. It was a great time. And we were all there together. I mean, it was a lot of fun.
How long were you guys out there for? How many weeks were you out there?
I can't remember. I don't know. A month or two, something like that.
Uh-huh.
We were there a long time.
And you were rooming with Mike Katz,
We were training for Mr. America at the time. And
Robbie. And your roommate was Mike Katz when you guys were out there, right?
My roommate was Mike Katz. Oh, my God, was he funny. So he wanted me to send his shoes back on the plane or something. And he had these huge feet. I go, Mike, go buy a pair of, you know, kids. It's going to cost me more to send them on an airplane than they're worth. You know, what, do they have some sentimental value or something? It's like, come on.
You might need to
send them back on the plane. But we laugh. Well, Mike and I were in Sports Illustrated together when they did the piece on bodybuilding.
Oh, yeah, in 74, yeah.
Because he had played for the Jets, and I was from Michigan State, and
right.
We kind of had that color thing going, like the Celtics, you know, the green and white thing. So
mm-hmm.
We hit it off, and when he came to California, we hung out together, and I had this old 53 Ford, and the bands on it were loose, and he goes, we were driving somewhere, and he goes, won't this thing go any faster? And I said, Mike, this thing is run by a rat on a treadmill, and I'm low on cheese. And he laughs, and we laugh. We got a lot of laughs about that.
Right.
But people don't realize, you know, he was kind of wooden and stiff because he'd broken his neck, you know, with the Jets.
Wow.
So he was lucky to even work out.
Yeah, you know, really.
Because they didn't have – nowadays he probably would have been able to keep playing, you know, or had a career.
Yeah.
Back then, when you had a spinal neck injury, that was it. You know, they wouldn't clear you.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And that was the reason he was kind of, you know, stiff. But
yeah,
Arnold and I would tease him because he'd wear these shirts, and they looked like they were mediums or something. Like the buttons were just ready to rip.
Right.
And then, so Arnold and I go, well, let's wait till he goes to sleep to see if his chest stays up. So we turn on the light, and then sure enough, his chest was always up like that.
That's what was so great about that era was you guys all hung out together and you partied together, and it was so low key,
yeah.
And you had so much fun. And I think when people watch the movie Pumping Iron now, I think that's what they really get out of it. It just seemed like
yeah.
so much fun, and it was just such a great time back then.
Well, I was kind of mad because I was in St. Louis that summer.
Yeah.
Working at it, and then I came back, and then they'd already finished filming, and then George and Charles Gaines decided that they needed another scene, so they put the football thing in there. And Rob, of course, Robbie and I and Waller were the only ones who could play football, so.
Yeah, tell us about the T-shirt, because you said that was all your idea, right?
It was my idea because I was rooming with Mike, and I knew he wasn't in shape. And he would all, after we work out, he'd always be looking for his shirt because he wanted to put it on.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when the guys from California, we're running around in tank tops. We're in shape the whole time. We don't give a shit if you're looking at us because we're in shape.
Right.
But when a bodybuilder's not in shape, you know, you're a little vain. You're like a guy with a robe. You might take it off and you want to put it right back on.
Yeah.
Well, that's how he was with that sweatshirt because it was kind of like his security blanket.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of hit home in the movie. And, but I liked Mike so much because he was such a good family man. And he was just a good guy.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like an underhanded thing. It was
mm-hmm.
more of a funny thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the movie made it look like Waller was a prankster and it was all these things. I mean, Arnold actually hid Sergio's posing trunks on him, so he had to use a different color.
Oh, really?
It would, yeah. I mean, guys, we did shit like that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it was gamesmanship.
Yeah, you were rooming with Mike and Stay Hungry, and then you told Waller you should hide his T-shirt when you get out there because he's not really in shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Waller wasn't the bad guy. It was me. He was just the initiator. I was the initiator. He was the guy who actually did it.
Right. So then they filmed that football scene where you guys were planning to do that. They filmed that after the whole contest was over.
No, the universe, I don't think, was over.
Oh, it wasn't.
They hadn't gone and done that yet.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. No, that part was real. Actually, okay. People think there was a script. There was no script for that movie. It was just everybody ad-libbing.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think of the movie when you first saw it, Roger?
It was all right. I was kind of pissed off that I wasn't there, you know. It made me mad that I wished I wouldn't have went to St. Louis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was good, you know. There was hammy stuff like Ed Giuliani running and jumping in Arnold's arms and all that goofy shit.
Yeah.
You know, camera. A lot of guys, when the camera rolls, they do shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like a guy in a bar. He's going to say something stupid. You know, oh, you're a bodybuilder. Well, you're probably not strong, you know.
Bullshit.
When the camera's rolling, the guys who aren't actors and aren't used to being on film, they do kind of egotistical things, that what I would call egotistically motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a little bit of that because I know all those guys well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that part was a little corny, some of it, you know.
Are you surprised now, like 40 years later, what a iconic film that is and what a big impact it had? I mean, it was kind of a small film when it was released. I remember I actually saw it in a theater in 1977. There was like five people in there. And now, you know, 40 years later, it's like, it's the film about bodybuilding.
I was in Montana. I was in Reno, Nevada. Well, I was in Montana, and I went behind a gas station to take a leak. And I hear some guy say, "Didn't you used to be Roger Callard?" I turn around, and there's this guy with his shirt off, and he's out there. He looks like, you know, the wild man from Borneo or something. You know, he's gathering tires, and I go, "What are you doing here?" And he goes, "Oh, I got some bad luck. I'm getting recycling tires so I can get some money to get back on the road." And I go, "How did you recognize me?" He said, "Well, I saw your back."
Really?
And I realized, John, at that point, this fucking magazine, this whole thing is getting out there.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize there was no internet. There were no cell phones.
Right.
You don't realize that there's the power of the media.
Yeah.
And now, suddenly, this is 1978, I'm realizing this is going around the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People actually read these things, and the circulation is astronomical. It's exponential.
Yeah.
So am I surprised? A little. That kind of surprised me, but then, you know, now with the internet and, you know, all the different publications,
mm-hmm.
And I think we are hearkening back to pure era.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what Bruce Ebel's trying to do with that natural Mr. America that I'm involved with and
mm-hmm.
Mike Zane's involved with. Because we want to bring back kind of a classical look.
Yeah.
You know, like Zane or myself or Samir. You know, guys from that era didn't look like, you know, androids. We looked like guys who could do stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we could run, we could jump, we could hit a baseball. And, you know, and I think that's why we're instituting an athletic portion into the Mr. America as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. You know, almost like the, you know, in the Inception when guys had to do, you know, like Remick was a good athlete.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that we need to go back to that.
Yeah.
You know, it can't just be a guy up there posing.
Right.
It's got to be. I mean, why do you think CrossFit is so compelling?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you seen that guy who won like five of them in a row?
Yeah.
He was like he looked like Rich. What was his name? Rich. Can't think of his last name, but he could have been a professional bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Strong as hell. I mean.
Right.
That's what we need to promote. And that's kind of what I was trying to do when I was competing
mm-hmm.
and when I was training is to do something. That's why I did the 50 reps.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something that in 50 years, 40 years, people look at it, scratch their head and go, how the hell did he do it?
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your acting career too, Roger, because I know you're in a lot of movies and you've been in that for a long time.
Well, what happened was, when I was in high school, my football coach was the drama coach.
Okay.
And he says, I want you guys to come out for the senior, junior, senior play. And I go, Coach, I don't want to be in, that's a bunch of, you know, I don't want to be in the band. I don't want to be in the choir. I don't want to be in the, he goes, the cheerleaders are going to be in the play. I go, okay, I'm in. So, because there was this one cheerleader I wanted to get next to.
Yeah.
And I ended up winning the Dramatics Award. We did a thing called The Mouse That Roared.
Uh-huh.
It was about this little country that had this Q-bomb and kind of held the world at ransom. And that kind of bit me, you know, the bug right
mm-hmm.
there, because I was voted by my peers. So when I came to California, Arnold already knew that I knew about acting. So whenever he would go to an acting class, he would take me, or if he went to a publicist company or something he didn't understand, he would take me with him because he knew that I knew, you know, the machinations and kind of the inner workings of the business. So that's really how I got started. And then we were down at the beach, and a guy named Peanuts West came around. He goes, do you guys want to be in the movie? And I go, well, who's in? And he goes, Kurt Russell. I said, oh, great. And then Kurt and I became friends. And Kurt was actually a hell of a baseball player. I don't know if you know. That's why he's such a good golfer. He was drafted by the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, I interviewed him recently, and he was talking about that.
Oh, he was a hell of a baseball player. Garvey. And he tore up his knee or his shoulder, and that's why he went back to Disney, started doing all those World's Strongest Man, and the Computer Will Finish You, and that whole series. Because before that, all he'd done was Gallagher. His dad, Russell, was in the John Russell was in the film business too. He was a director. I know Mike Treese, a good friend of mine, knew him, but he was from the Valley, but he was a hell of a baseball player. And his buddy that was in the movie ended up writing Fame, and that's how I kind of got started. And then I started doing guest starring, and, you know, I did Wonder Woman and Barnaby Jones and Streets of San Francisco and Man Called Sloan. And I just went from one episodic, and then I started, you know, getting lead guest star roles. And
some of those 1970s TV series, they featured a lot of bodybuilders, right? Like you said, Streets of San Francisco. I remember that one.
That one was because Mike Priest, who was a friend of Walter Hill's, his mother was the head of the script supervisors union, and he became a director, and he came down to the beach and he said, I'm doing Streets of San Francisco. Would you and Arnold like to be in it? And we said, yeah, sure, of course. And then, you know, a lot of us worked in that. And then there was a guy named Joe Corso from San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
who was in the show. And, that turned out to be actually a pretty good show, because that was one of Mike Priest's first films. And I did about 10 shows with him.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he ended up doing Dallas and Falcon's Crest and Hunter. And he became a huge TV director. I did a lot of Walker, Texas Rangers with him. And he was also a friend of Brad Harris's. And, it was kind of a small community of actors and, you know, bodybuilders at that time at the gym,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
especially at Gold's.
Yeah.
You know, any given day. You know? And, of course, there was guys like Clint who worked out, Ernest Borgnine, Robert Blake, Vince, the guy who played Ben Casey, what was his name?
Yeah.
Vince Edwards. Ty Hart.
They were crowded at Vince's gym mostly, right?
Vince,
or were they going to Gold's?
They would come over to Gold's too.
Yeah.
Tony Franciosa. I mean, just a ton of actors that worked out that came, that, you know, would come to the gym.
Right.
Gregory Hines. I mean, you name it.
And then when Arnold...
Isaac Hayes used to come to the gym.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a big bodybuilding fan.
Yep. the LL Cool Jam, you know, all those guys.
And then when Arnold's career took off, you were in a lot of his movies, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I did like seven of his films.
Wow. Yeah, I remember you were in Twins. You had Red Heat.
Running Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did a bunch of stuff.
So when you saw Arnold really take off in Hollywood, were you surprised knowing him all those years and Golds? And I mean, could you see anything?
No, because I was with him when we walked into the publicity company. You know, he was a publicity stunt that worked. We went in and we met with a guy named Mark Landia with a company called ICPR. And Arnold and I sat down. And Arnold says, "What do you do?" And Mark said, "Well, Arnold, we elect presidents, we elect governors, we elect actors. We put you on the right side of issues. We say things about you that if you said would sound braggadocio. We put you on the right talk shows.
Mm-hmm.
We put you in the right newspapers. We get you the right agent." And at the end of that, the guy, Mark Landia, said, "What do you want, Arnold?" And Arnold said, "I want everyone in America to know my name in a year." And it cost him $2,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like 75.
Wow, you know? $2,000 a month.
And that's when it took off.
Wow.
And that's when it took off.
Hmm.
Well, I remember when he met Maria, he came, because Roger, I just met this really nice girl named Maria Shriver. I really like her. And I go, "Do you know her uncle is JFK? And he goes, "Who's JFK? I go, "You idiot. John Fitzgerald Kennedy." He goes, "Are you kidding me?" He didn't know.
Wow, really?
And then that year, 78, she shows up at the Olympia in Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
She sneaks off and meets him. And I was doing a seminar the next day, and I just won, you know, the international. And for some reason, Arnold didn't have a room for me. So I went up to his room. I go, "Arnold, what the hell is going on? I don't have a room." And Maria came out, and she goes, "Look at him. He's mad. I go, "Arnold, get this little rich brat out of my face and get me a room." He goes, "Oh, come on, Roger. Come in. You can have the other side of the suite." She never forgot that, but I told
really?
Her off because I didn't give a shit. You know.
Right.
Well, what's funny, my dad knew Joe Kennedy. They didn't realize it until we did Red Heat in Chicago. We were at the Merchandise Mart, and they were giving us a tour of the building, Arnold and I and Maria. And I hear, "Roger, Roger." I look over, and it's my cousin who has a crystal shop there.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnold and Maria looked at me like, "What's your cousin doing here?" And I said, "Well, our family has known them for a lot of years. My dad knew Jones. She had no idea." And they go, "Well, what's this crystal shop? And that's a lot of money right there, isn't it?" And my cousin said, "Yeah, it's $5.2 million worth of crystal on the floor." And they looked at me like, "Who the hell are you?" They had no idea that my dad knew Joe. Because Maria, she was a little baby. I mean, she doesn't know, you know. She was 10 years younger than we were, so.
Right,
you know. But she didn't know that much about Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad was born in 1897. You know, he was in the Navy.
Wow.
So he knew, yeah. When Joe Kennedy purchased the Merchandise Mart in 1929, it was the largest real estate purchase in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Square footage, bigger than the Pentagon.
Wow.
And it was notable because he bought it for $29 million, less than what it took to build it during the Depression.
Hmm.
And that's really where he made a lot of his money, besides, you know, booze.
Yeah. Wow.
And I knew about that business, too, because my dad was involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was kind of funny. It was kind of funny because they had no idea, you know, my connection and the fact that Michigan was where the booze came in from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the scene in The Untouchables. Remember the movie with Sean Connery?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when everybody scrambles at the border. That was the UP of Michigan.
Huh, okay.
My dad was one of those guys. He was one of those untouchables.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of history here.
Going back to your bodybuilding years, Roger, who were the guys you really were real good friends with and hung around with? Arnold, Ken Waller?
Manny Perry, Denny Gable.
Yeah.
Kent Keene, you know, Bill Grant, Frank Zane. Frank and I were good friends.
Yeah.
Ken Waller, of course. But Frank and I did a lot of stuff together. Actually, Zabel and I did a lot of stuff together, and Dave Draper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was good friends with Casey Viator.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of guys that we were friends with. You know, I mean, there's almost too many to mention. I mean, those are just the famous guys. But you know, there were a lot of other people that came and went, and
yeah,
there were a lot of people coming out from California. I mean, come from New York and you know, from Europe. You know, it was an exodus every summer. You know, there was somebody new. Yeah.
Who really impressed you as a bodybuilder, Roger? I know you mentioned Sergio Oliva a little earlier, but you know,
I think was the most gifted of all time. If you look at the silhouette of his body, and I mean, he was 5'9", and the shape, and people forget he was the Pan American Games 198 pound Olympic lifting champ. He was strong as hell.
Yeah,
you know, he was very powerful. I mean, he got shot with a 357 Magnum, and he still lived.
Yeah, three times.
Yeah. I mean, think if that doesn't happen to him, you know. And he came back like in his 50s, and he was good, still good, after he'd gotten shot.
Yeah.
You know, he was an amazing guy. I like Sergio.
Yeah, he was.
He came up to me one time, and he goes, "You know," and he had this little kind of accent. He goes, "You know, Ryan," he goes, "you're really good." And to me, that was the greatest compliment I ever got.
Yeah.
Because when I won the USA, he was guest poser up in San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And I'd actually known him, you know, since the 60s. I saw him do 50 reps on the bench with 300 pounds.
Wow.
I stopped counting at like 40 reps. I mean, he was so freaking strong, John. I mean, just crazy strong.
Yeah, I used to see Sergio, because I grew up in Chicago, so I used to see him come to the shows, and this was like in the early 1980s. And I try to tell people today how amazing he looked, and it's hard to describe, you know?
No, they have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, again, people think that everything gets better because of, you know, and that's not true.
Right.
There are classics, you know? It's like a car.
Right.
There are the 65 Corvette. I mean, you look at that body style. And bodybuilders, athletes, the same, you know. It has nothing to do with, you know, we're getting better and this and that.
Yeah.
Great athletes come from all eras, you know.
Yeah.
Just because it's happening now doesn't mean they're the best. They're just the best right now.
Right. What do you think of Danny Padilla? Because I know you guys, you had a show down in 77, right, when you won the America.
I think that I got robbed in that show because Franco wanted a little man to win, and they actually had me ahead. And Franco had Dot Kawashima change his votes because Danny was not in shape for the show.
Yeah, he was white and chewing gum and everything.
I was supposed to win. And I did win, but they gave it to him, and he knows it too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I didn't take a lot of crap, and I didn't, you know, I didn't play the game, and and Weider, you know, and Franco rigged the show, so everybody knows that.
How'd you get along with Weider?
Donald Wong wrote a big article about how it was a travesty of justice. And,
how'd you get along with Joe Weider, Roger?
You know, I like Joe, even though he, you know, he screwed me in ways. But he was like a playful guy. Ben, I didn't care for.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe was funny. Joe was very funny. I mean, he had a good heart, you know. But you know, he screwed people over. He screwed me over a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But I still liked him.
Yeah.
He was very comical. I mean, he was very comical.
Yeah.
We used to do a lot of touring, and we'd go around to, you know, malls. We went to that big mall in Kansas City, and
mm-hmm.
I had to demonstrate a bunch of equipment, and I'd never even seen it. And I told Joe, I said, don't just let me figure out what this stuff is. And he gets up, and Joe hated public speaking. He was very afraid of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd get up there and he'd set a pen and his voice would start shaking. And now here's Roger. And as I'm walking by, I go, you son of a bitch. And I get up there and I just wing it, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had no idea what this crusher or anything was. And so we go back to our hotel and we got a suite. And he's over on one side and I'm over on the other. And he comes over and he goes, You know, Roger, I was quite a bodybuilder when I was young. And he takes cover off the lamp, and he goes, look at my most muscular. And he's posing in front of me. I'm laying in bed, and he's posing. It's like midnight. I go, Joe, turn the fucking light off. And he goes, oh, you bodybuilders, you got no sense of humor. I mean, we laughed so freaking hard about that. I mean, he goes, you know, Rosé, it was hard being a Jew growing up in Montreal. I had to fight every day. I go, come on, Joe, you didn't fight anybody. Well, when I was doing my bodybuilding courses, I had it all over the house, and my mother went crazy because the ink was drying everywhere. And he'd laugh like, he thought that was just so funny that he had all of his stuff,
right.
You know, but I knew the history of his whole thing. You know, he grew up in Montreal. And it probably was hard being a Jew in Montreal.
Yeah.
He probably did get the shit beat out of him.
Right, right.
And then he moved to New York and then out to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he wasn't the architect of bodybuilding. I mean, he rode on our backs, basically, is what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben went around and, you know, spread the seeds, you know, with the IFBB.
Yeah.
But all of that Weider principles were just all of our articles that we wrote.
Right.
It was somebody transcribing our workouts, instinctive training and giant sets and supersets.
Yeah.
No, that was all our stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I liked Joe. I always liked Joe. And when he was sick at the end, I remember I was down at the beach and he called me over and I sat with him and
mm-hmm.
that was one of the, and then Betty wanted me to set up a dinner for him and my wife had got cancer and I wasn't able to go and then Joe died a few years later or a year later.
Mm.
But, I used to go to his house, and I did a lot of work for him because I was a carpenter, and he loved that. I built a lot of his cabinets for the artwork that he had and pedestals.
Yeah.
Did a lot of work on his house. I was always over there. Yeah.
You went to a lot of Arnold's parties, too, right? I remember seeing a picture of you and Waller and at his 30th birthday party.
Well, Joe loaned me the money to get into the Screen Actors Guild. He loaned me the money.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, I'll pay you back. And he goes, oh, I don't worry about it. I go, no, I'll pay you back. And it was the best thing I ever did. But Joe loaned me the money.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. No, Joe and I were good friends. I always liked Joe, even though, you know, we had our differences.
Mm-hmm.
But,
how were the parties at Arnold's house?
The parties?
Yeah, when Arnold always had parties at his house.
Oh, they were great. We all had them. We had them at my house. We had them at his house.
Yeah.
they were great. I mean, Chuck Norris would be there, the Cassidys, and
yeah,
oh shit, Jack Nicholson and Clint, and you know,
wow,
the who's who of whoever was around.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, Jake Bloom was Stallone's manager, and he was Arnold's
mm-hmm.
manager. Well, the guy who did the Lords of Flatbush was a friend of mine, and he ended up dying, but that really launched Erwin Winkler and Sly and, was it Dennis Leary? Or there's three or four guys that were in the Lords of Flatbush.
Henry Winkler.
Who?
Henry Winkler.
Yeah, Henry Winkler and Stallone. But then
yeah,
there was another guy, too.
Perry King, right?
Who?
Perry King.
I don't know. I can't remember his name. There was about three or four guys that were in it, and they all,
yeah,
that was their beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was a very small community, really. I mean,
yeah,
and Hollywood is a small community.
Right.
You know, it's not the big thing that people think it is.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, my association with Arnold and the bodybuilders hurt me in acting, because it's like putting a round peg in a square hole.
Mm-hmm.
They categorize you. They,
yeah,
pigeonhole you. They see you as one thing. And I was really, you know, a much better actor than the roles I was given.
Mm-hmm.
But I was typecast.
Yeah. When did you move out of California, Roger?
2010. I moved,
okay,
back to Michigan. My wife was cancer in 2008, and they said that there was nothing more they could do for her, so we came back here to Michigan, and she lived another 3 years.
Okay.
So I figured if I was going to go through something like that, I wanted to be back, you know, in a environment like this where I could kind of mentally,
yeah,
and physically deal with it. And as it turned out, it was a great decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very happy to be where I'm at.
Uh-huh.
I'm working with, you know, I'm developing a weight machine. I'm developing a protein powder.
Hmm.
I'm writing songs for a couple movies. I'm writing scripts. And I'm
really?
Much more productive. Yeah. I'm much more,
okay,
productive, John, than I was over there.
Yeah. So you're still sort of involved with the movies a little bit, huh?
Definitely, yeah. I'm going to do a movie,
yeah,
here in the fall in Charlevoix and in Upper Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I got kind of tied into the movie community here, which is, there's quite a few people, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Jeff Daniels is from here, Tom Selleck, Gilda,
okay,
Radner, Robin Williams. I mean, there were a lot of, again, a lot of great actors from here as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a great, okay, state, Michigan. It's a beautiful state.
Yeah.
It's like New York. I mean, people, they think New York is New York City, and they think Michigan is Detroit, and nothing could be further from the truth. You,
right,
go upstate New York and upstate Michigan, it's beautiful.
Yeah, totally different, right?
Totally different. It's like L.A.,
mm-hmm,
that's not California.
Yeah.
You know, drive up to Santa Barbara, go up to Big Sur.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our preconceptions about locales is tied to a big city.
Yeah.
You know, people think you have to be, that's another thing, that people think that they have to be from those places to be famous. And I always tell them, places don't make people famous. People make places famous, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Larry Bird was from French Lick, and Magic Johnson was from Lansing, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be from L.A. or New York or,
yeah,
Philadelphia, or you can be from a little speck on the map.
Right, right. Well, we wish you the best of luck with all your new projects, Roger. I hope you're successful in all
Thank
of them.
John. Thank you, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to tell a few stories and But it's a history, really. You know,
yeah.
People, they don't realize what has transpired to make things the way they are today. And
right.
You know, we walk on a lot of men's shoulders, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say that if you're on a bus or you're somewhere, there's greatness all around you.
Yeah.
We just know who they are. And you open a door for somebody, you know, if he opens the door for you, say thank you. He might be a war hero. He might be, you know, you don't know who he is.
Yeah.
I never trivialize a man's or a woman's kindness. You know, and that's what we do nowadays. We take a lot of things for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like we were talking about last week when we talked on the phone, that really was a magical time in bodybuilding. And like you said, it'll probably never be repeated again. And it really was the groundwork for changing physical fitness in America, you know, that movie.
Changing the ideology of the world, really. Because
mm-hmm.
now our concept of what we thought was weird suddenly became the norm.
Yeah.
I mean, look at our bodies now compared to the guys, and it's a pretty vast difference.
Yeah.
But I think if you took those pictures in a bar and you asked some girls who would they rather be with, they'd pick our pictures.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it just shows how far we've gone.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I don't like the direction it's going in, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Bellies and the,
right.
You know, they can't walk. And I don't know. It doesn't seem healthy to me.
Yeah. Well, I don't think
a lot of them are going to be around in 50 years or 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hearing your stories about how the way you guys used to train and, you know, how athletic you were and how functional you were and how you guys look great all the time. I mean, I think that's the ideal. You know, that's the bodybuilding ideal.
It has to be a lifestyle. You know, you can't diet. There's no such thing as dieting.
Yeah.
It has to be a sound nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing will last, you know, unless it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's really what that era was about, is that, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but we did it because we loved it. And we all came to that Mecca, so to speak, because we knew that the best would gather there. It was almost like
mm-hmm.
we were following, you know, like the wise men following the star.
Right.
We went there because we knew that the best were going to be there. And if we wanted to be the best, we kind of felt like that's where we had to go to
right.
achieve it.
Right.
It might not have been the case, but it certainly made that era something very special because now you had these guys from all over the world gathering in this little small gym and that minuscule subculture changes the world.
Yeah, that gym, Gold's Gym was only, the original Gold's was only about a little over 3,000 square feet, right?
I don't even think it was that big, John.
Really? Wow. That's just amazing when you think about it.
I would think it wasn't much more than 50 by 50.
Wow, really? That's crazy.
Yeah. It was less than 3,000.
Hmm.
I actually remodeled that building because I know they were 16-foot ceilings.
Uh-huh.
Because Brian Abadie and I actually, you know, remodeled it for Ken Sprague.
Right.
And I think one of the Jacksons bought the house. I don't know if it was Randy Jackson. One of the Jackson 5 bought the house.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it wasn't that big, John. It was small.
Wow. That's incredible.
It's like when you go back to, you know, your house where you were born.
Yeah.
It's smaller exactly. than what you thought.
Right.
It always seemed big when you were young.
Yeah, or your school that you went to when you were young, it's the same thing.
Yeah, they're small, they're tiny. Yep.
All right, Roger. Well, I just want to thank you again for joining us for this interview. It was a lot of great stories, and to celebrate the 40th anniversary, and you were around during that time, so it was really great getting your stories and your input.
Well, thank you. You know, I was lucky to be a part of a tremendous era, and again, there were a lot of guys that I didn't mention. as I probably should have mentioned, but they know who they are, and we were all a part of that time. And
yeah,
I'm just thankful that I was there. And it's kind of like one of those moments in life when you're almost outside yourself, and you mm-hmm. know that this is a special time.
Yeah,
and that's what that time was. We all knew it was going to be special. We just didn't know how special. And
right.
I think historically it'll grow in time even more, and the impact of it when it's studied will even be more impactful than what it is today.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Well, thank you, John. And
all right, Roger.
Thank the producer and everybody, and good luck with your podcast and your popularity out there. I hope it grows, and I think these stories need to be told too.
Yeah, I do too. You know, it's close to my heart. I mean, this is my passion, so it's great talking to guys like you. Well, you know, that I grew up reading about, and it's great hearing the old stories.
Well, when you talk to Mike, tell him I'm sorry. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
Tell him I still love him.
All right.
All right. Tell him I got more cheese now for my car. I'll be off. I'll be fine.
Right.
All right, man. You guys have a good one.
All right, Roger. Take care. Thanks again.
Good night.
Good night. All right. That was great. Thanks to Roger Callard for joining us. That was my first time actually talking to Roger, so that was a great experience. Someone I'd read about in the magazines for so many years. Join us next week. Our guest will be 1974 Mr. World Bill Grant. And Bill was also part of that Gold's Gym crew, and he was out there in South Africa for the Mr. Olympia contest. I believe that was Bill's first Mr. Olympia contest. He's got some great stories to tell us next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks for joining us, guys. We'll see you next week.